From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I don't have the privilege of being, I want it to be a theatrical release. Like, I'm just trying to, you know, keep making movies. And that's what so many people who make films on the margins feel like.
Ava DuVernay's documentary, 13th, traces the history of racism and mass incarceration in America. Because she made the film for Netflix, she had to forego seeing it on the big screen, and she's okay with that. DuVernay tells us why, following her Oscar-nominated film Selma, she turned down an offer from Marvel to make 13th, and how she managed to make the Oscar-nominated documentary while also overseeing Queen Sugar on the OWN network and directing Disney's big-budget A Wrinkle in Time. But first on the News Banter, Viacom tries a reset and a couple of big agencies respond to Trump. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my fellow banterer, Matt Bellany, who has a fancy new title at The Hollywood Reporter. Congratulations, Matt. You are now editorial director.
Yes, but I remain your editorial sidekick on the radio.
My faithful sidekick. Thank you. So, Viacom. You know, I would say that Philippe Dumont, the now ousted CEO and at one point chairman of the Viacom, which is the company that has Nickelodeon, Comedy Central, BET, MTV, and of course Paramount Pictures, that guy was a one-man wrecking ball. He just demolished that place. He took hundreds of millions of dollars over the course of his tenure. And now this company, it's such weak condition with cable channels that aren't working and Paramount in last place among the studios. And Bob Bakish, who has been named his successor, he was a guy that is not really known in the entertainment community. He was like an international guy doing other things elsewhere. He is trying to salvage this. He announced a plan to try to just relaunch in a way, and kind of an echo of the Disney silo strategy, except he's trying to use these labels that are, for the most part, with maybe the exception of Nickelodeon, pretty battered.
Yeah, they're saying that they are going to focus their strategy around their strongest cable television brands, which are MTV, Comedy Central, Nickelodeon, BET, and they're going to marginalize some of their lesser cable channels, and they're going to try to cross-breed and cross-pollinate with the Paramount film studio. So there will be more SpongeBob movies, and they'll try to do Comedy Central movies and things like that. And as part of that, the Spike Television Network, which has been a male-focused network, is going to be rebranded as the Paramount Network with content to be named, and we assume will include a lot of the Paramount movies that Viacom has. And, you know, this is all part of what appears to be a strategy to mimic what Disney has done with its silos of Marvel with the comic book movies and Lucasfilm with the Star Wars movies and Pixar and Disney Animation in the animation space.
Yeah, so there's one problem with that, which is that those are like cornucopias of incredible franchise material, whereas MTV, like, you know, you're sort of going, I'm thinking like Jersey Shore, what year was that?
Well, you know, you could make the argument that Disney Animation was struggling and has made a tremendous comeback with movies like Frozen and Zootopia. So there can be turnarounds, and I think Bob Bakish is taking over Viacom at a time where there's only one way to go, and that could be up. you know, but he's going to have to do it in a very challenged landscape where these cable networks are not the cash cows they once were and are facing this prospect of people turning to skinny bundles and eliminating channels and over-the-top delivery where people aren't going to necessarily pay $100 for a cable TV package. So it's a challenged landscape.
And, of course, the pressure is on at Paramount Pictures, especially if they're looking to make these movies, you know, the MTV something movie and the Comedy Central something movie, whatever. As I said, Paramount's in last place. Brad Gray, the head of the studio, many people in Hollywood have said, how do you keep surviving with the studio in last place? They're trying to have it sort of both ways with this announcement that they made in the last few days, which is, you know, it's not good enough, but we're going to give him a chance. So he is a little bit, you know, on the ledge, I would say, at this point.
Right. But in defense of Brad Gray, and I think that, you know, the studio has had challenges for a number of reasons. The messaging that we have heard is that the studio's hands had been tied by Philippe Dumont and the Viacom management. There was not investment in building new properties. They were managing quarter to quarter to preserve the quarterly earnings, to extract more money and bonuses and things like that. So the argument, at least, is that now with Viacom focused on this studio, they will be able to invest and do more. But that puts pressure on him. They're saying, we're giving you a chance. Now, if you don't perform, you know, we'll see what happens then.
Yes, I'm sure that is the argument, and he would appreciate you making it, and people are going to wait and see. Let me just turn quickly to Hollywood and Trump. William Morris Endeavor announced the formation of a PAC, a political action committee, very vague what the PAC is supposed to do. And then right afterwards, United Talent Agency, UTA, announced that they are going to give $250,000 to the ACLU in lieu of their Oscar party that they hold every year. And they will have a rally at their offices a couple of days before the Oscars instead. And, you know, I think that the UTA messaging has been a huge hit with a lot of their clients. This is liberal community for the most part. WME is more awkwardly situated. Not only was Ari Emanuel Donald Trump's agent and has visited him in the not distant past post-election, but they have a very large company. They have the Bull Riding Association or whatever.
UFC.
Yes, not necessarily uniformly liberal by any means. And so this thing with the PAC is like, I don't know what it is, but we're doing it.
Right. And I think this is an attempt by WME to send a message to clients saying, you know, we may have a relationship with Trump. And Ari has always said that, you know, he wants to have a relationship and try to be influential with Trump if he can. But we have our core basic values and we are going to pursue them. And that, you know, they cited diversity and a couple of other buzzwords. But it is an awkward situation for them. And I think UTA, in the battle of positioning on this issue, UTA has the upper hand in Hollywood because they are very clear. They are not supporting what Trump is doing. And their clients, for the most part of what we've seen, have reacted very positively to this.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. How busy is director Ava DuVernay? Really, really busy. So busy that the only time she could sit down for our interview was a Saturday afternoon. You said you were shooting until midnight last night.
I was shooting until midnight last night. Yes. We shoot in Santa Clarita. So it's an hour away. So I got home a little after one. And I remember just thinking, oh, nice. I don't have to work tomorrow.
That shoot is Disney's A Wrinkle in Time. Right now, DuVernay's in the middle of production. She also is the executive producer of the TV series Queen Sugar, which starts its second season on the Oprah Winfrey Network later this year. And DuVernay's been on the awards circuit. Her film 13th is in the Oscar race for Best Documentary Feature, making her the first African-American woman nominated in that category. 13th refers to the constitutional amendment that abolished slavery in America, except as a punishment for crime. Through archival clips and talking heads, among them author Michelle Alexander, the film reveals how this loophole has been exploited to oppress African Americans since the days immediately following emancipation.
After the Civil War, African Americans were arrested en masse. It was our nation's first prison boom.
Through the law and order presidencies of the 70s and 80s, when the racism was expressed in code.
President Richard Nixon was the first to coin the term a war on drugs, but President Ronald Reagan turned that rhetorical war into a literal one.
13th also examines the growth of the private prison industry and the exploitation of inmate labor to make everything from missile parts to blue jeans. 13th made history last September when it became the first documentary to open the New York Film Festival. A few days later, it appeared on Netflix. Until then, DuVernay had kept the project off the radar. But she says people who think she was trying to keep it secret are mistaken.
Nah, it wasn't secret. It was quiet. Quiet is probably the better term. I just didn't feel like it was the kind of project that you need to announce in the trades. You know what I mean?
We want everything to be announced.
Yeah, you know, it was a documentary.
In our trade. My
trade. It's a documentary that's about something very intimate. It's about race and the way that we all deal with it and interact with it and trying to find the through lines and the connections and how I was going to piece it together. And then also there's something about being too loud about that stuff that would inhibit who I was able to actually get to speak to me on camera. I mean, I'm really proud of the fact that it was, you know, you have conservatives that wouldn't usually sit down with, you know, with someone like me who's clearly a Black woman liberal filmmaker to talk about some of these things. And so I just thought it was best kept to do it quietly.
Well, I'll just stop on that for a sec, because I saw you and Van Jones and Oprah Winfrey at this event you did at Ted Sarandos' house a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And to my shock, I have to admit, Van Jones said he is like Newt Gingrich's his mentor and da-da-da-da, and he's in your film.
Van was the one who gave me his number.
Right, I figured. I thought, okay, now I understand.
How am I calling Newt Gingrich? Yeah.
Because there was a little moment in the film when I was, before the event, when I was watching the film, thinking,
how did that?
Newt Gingrich, okay.
Yeah.
But Newt Gingrich, it feels like he's in your film infinitely more reasonable than he plays in my Twitter feed, for example.
We absolutely should have treated crack and cocaine as exactly the same thing. I think it was an enormous a burden on the Black community, but it also fundamentally violated a sense of core fairness.
Well, it was a pre-Trump Newt Gingrich that I spoke with. I would be fascinated and riveted and very anxious to sit down with him now. When I sat down with him, he was in a place of, you know, kind of like the bipartisanship that's the talk of the moment. When we made this, it's no longer the talk of the moment. But he was in that space, and he was going around the country with Van Jones, talking about it at different gatherings that were looking at incarceration. And so I knew that he was thinking about these issues, and so it was important to have someone from that side of the aisle. Now it feels like that's been completely abandoned as he's, you know, focused on talking about other things.
It does feel a bit like the worms have turned.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You have clips of Trump. I don't know, if in your film you talk about Trump's ad, the ad he took out in the New York Times calling for the death penalty for the Central Park Five, which he's never apologized for.
Very recently he just reiterated his assertion that they're guilty.
They're guilty of being young Black kids, I guess.
Pretty much.
The crime. And then, you know, the election happens. I don't know, when you were making the film, did you foresee that it would be coming out in this environment?
No. Started the film, I actually got the call from Lisa Nishimura at Netflix the week after Oscars in 2015. So that was Selma's year. And it was around the time that I was talking with Marvel about Black Panther when I got this offer from Lisa Nishimura. Do you want to make a documentary about anything that you want? And
that probably stops you, you know?
Yeah,
do
it was, it was my fourth doc. And so I always knew that I wanted to do more documentary, but I felt like they just had a little bit more to say after Selma. And there was just things on my mind. You know, we were in the midst of a really big Black Lives Matter moment that hadn't really quite solidified into a movement that it is now. And so my mind and my heart and my spirit were in a place where I just wanted to, you know, more deeply explore some of those things that I had dealt with in Selma. As we got closer and closer, like in the summer, as we were getting closer to locking and Trump became the nominee and Hillary was the nominee, I thought there was something really important about making sure that in the film we went on record with what both of them thought about this issue. So we looked at her and Super Predators. We looked at him and Central Park Five. And then we fast forwarded to now and said, what are they talking about now? Because unknowingly, both of them had played a part in the cultural rhetoric around this issue, right? Back in the 80s and 90s and now. She was in a place where she was saying, I was wrong then. And she came out and talked about, you know, not even defending what she said, but basically saying that was that time and this is this time and those policies didn't work and this is what I'll do. And on the other hand, Trump was, you know, instigating violence and aggression towards people of color who were expressing dissent at his rallies.
I love the old days. You know what they used to do to guys like that when they were in a place like this? They'd be carried out on a stretcher, folks.
But, you know, not even when we released this in October of last year did I think we'd be in a moment where we'd be 2 weeks into a presidency and you'd have the kind of divisive, misogynistic, racist, anti-Muslim, anti-LGBT, really destructive and dangerous, not rhetoric now, but actions and orders, you know, that we're seeing now. So 13th is now bumping up against this moment in history in a way that's even more resonant than anything I could have imagined, unfortunately. Yeah.
Yeah. So Netflix, when they approached you, I'm sure you had a full plate because you're Ava.
Not really.
No,
after
you didn't.
Selma. Yeah, no, after Selma, it was, it wasn't like offers were pouring in, but that's something that I think is just more the norm for women filmmakers, truly. There were some nice things around, and this was one of them. It wasn't the thing that I think people thought I would choose.
Well, you didn't choose Marvel. I think we can guess why. I mean, Marvel works in a particular way.
Sure.
A director is kind of a small D director at Marvel. they do a lot of the film in post and tell you how they want it to be.
They have a certain way of working that didn't quite gel with the way that I prefer to work.
So maybe the understatement of this year's shows, but go ahead.
And you know, some directors thrive and will thrive in that kind of work environment. I think Ryan Coogler is going to thrive because he's a very strong personality and is going to be able to kind of assert his vision within that environment.
He probably will be in a better position than many.
I think he will be. And I'm excited to see what he does. For me, though, it's just about a choice. Do you want to fight that fight? Do you want to do it? I have that on one hand. And I had Netflix saying, would you like to make a documentary about anything you want? And we're just going to leave you alone and you can go do it. That was, at that moment, with the things that were in my heart and head, what I chose to do.
Any kind of helpful notes or unhelpful notes from Netflix?
Oh, my gosh. They're super smart in the doc space. I mean, I think they're smart all around, but I don't really know the rest of them. I only know my doc crew. And many, many helpful notes. You know, they left me alone for, like, gosh, like a year and a half. It wasn't until I was ready to show it that they even watched it. I didn't even really call except to check in and see if I needed anything, which is like, what the heck is going on? Who are you people? But they were fantastic. And so when I was ready to show it, they were really able to just give me some objective kind of outside of my crew feedback on how to get it down to the 100 minutes, which was my own mission for myself. I didn't want this to be longer than 100 minutes because I don't think people will watch something about race that's this intense for longer than that. You know, it was on the table to make it a documentary series or a two-part special. Like, I think at one point it was like 6 episodes or 4 episodes. But I just thought a 100-minute primer, kind of a shock and awe kind of thing, where you watch it and you just, bam, you smack into that sucker. And it raises your awareness and wants to trigger you to jump into action. And, you know, what could something like that do in that form, very compact? So that was what we were trying to do. But when I started and I first brought it to them maybe a year and a half after the start of it, it was longer. And so my question to them was like, give me some ideas to get this thing down. And part of that was more resources, more time, you know, things that could bridge the gap that meant a little bit more money. And they jumped into it and said yes.
They were cool with that. The money thing was not a thing.
Well, I mean, it's Netflix.
It's always like a thing.
They've got jacuzzis in the office. No, they don't. No, they don't. But I think they do somewhere back there.
They,
I mean, yeah.
I hope so, because one hears they work very hard.
They work very hard, yes.
Of course, the thing that bumps certain filmmakers is no theatrical release. I'm not sure that's as much of a concern when you're making a doc.
Well, it wouldn't be a concern for me even if it wasn't a doc. But
I'm interested about that.
I will. Well, let's go back to it. But first of all, documentaries in this country, in terms of theatrical releases, it's a really sad state of affairs, as is most independent films. You know, you'd be lucky if you get 1 week in the art house theater in LA or New York and no one in between will see it. And, you know, I bump up against this more than most because I have a distribution company called Array that favors films by women and people of color. So we're constantly trying to get our stuff into these smaller spaces. And everybody is, so it's not a lot of real estate. So that would have been the fate of this film, which is a film that I feel like needed to be more widely seen. So the idea of having it be something you could watch in your home, the intimacy of watching something about race in a place where you don't have to worry about who's watching you, what are you thinking, walking out, how you felt, crying, doing whatever the people have done with this film, which I've heard is a lot of emotion. I don't know, it felt something really organic to just doing that on your couch or wherever you wanted to watch it and engage with this information. So it worked out really well. And the fact that they got it out in 190 countries. You know, I've heard from people in countries I don't even know how to spell who've engaged with this in a way that kind of ricochets off of whatever's happening in their culture at the time. It's been really nourishing to me to see the ways in which this information is not known and the ways in which it connects with people in other places that we wouldn't even fathom.
Coming up after a short break, 13th director Ava DuVernay tells us how the death of her father last year drove her to take on 2 films and a television series at the same time. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Business and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to filmmaker Ava DuVernay about her Oscar-nominated documentary, 13th. The film is one of three major projects DuVernay has taken on since her film Selma was nominated for Best Picture in 2015. 13th, Disney's A Wrinkle in Time, and the own TV series Queen Sugar. Since 13th was made for Netflix, there was never any plan for a theatrical release, something that still matters a lot to most filmmakers. But for DuVernay, that's not a concern, and not just because 13th is a documentary.
So with a scripted film, you feel the same?
I do, because, you know, I will follow middle of nowhere. My first films were films that I distributed myself by hand through my own distribution collective. And for me, it's a lot less about the magnitude and majesty of the releases and more about the fact that I continue to be able to make films and have those films be seen. I mean, you know, the new report by USC and Stacey Smith just came out a couple days ago with just more dire numbers for women filmmakers and even worse numbers for women of color filmmakers. You know, to see that three black women filmmakers have made films that were in the top 1,000 films in the last 3 years and you're one of the names is not a good feeling. And so for me, it's just a matter of survival in the industry and survival with my images and to be able to have those films seen in any way possible by any means necessary is something that I embrace. I don't have the privilege of being, I want it to be a theatrical release. Like, I'm just trying to, you know, keep making movies. And that's what so many people who make films on the margins feel like. So, no, I mean, I'm happy to embrace Netflix or whatever else comes along. I think, like, 2 years from now, it'll be like hologram movies or something. I'll make those, too.
I don't know how to inform you of this, but you know A Wrinkle in Time is going to be a rather large theatrical release.
A Wrinkle in Time won't be forever. You know, this moment that I'm having right now won't be forever. Everyone in this industry, you know, very few people last in this kind of spotlight for a long time. And so I intend to make movies until I can't make them anymore. And I intend for that to be when I don't want to make them anymore. So I just have to safeguard against, you know, the illusion that I'm always going to be able to make a big Disney worldwide release. That'll be next, but what about after that?
You want to make sure you still fit into those britches.
Yeah, that's right.
How are you finding that? I just have to ask, like, this is a whole different, I mean, you've made scripted films, obviously, but this is like, whoa.
It feels perfectly natural to me. It's like making any other movie. It's just more days.
It's a big and more machine. Money.
It's and a big machine, but it's, I mean, when you're on your set, you're on your set. When you're, you know, working with the actor, you're working with the actor.
You don't
feel
that.
Yeah, more things blow up, and yes, there's, you're designing more things that fly, but that's the fun stuff that everyone wants to be able to do. So I've taken to it kind of like a fish to water. I enjoy every single minute. Nothing's hard. Feels fun. And I wish that more women, more people of color had the opportunity to play in this toy box.
I have to say you're a very positive person.
Yeah,
that's good.
But, it's been fun.
I mean, you don't feel the hot breath of that Disney image making. I mean, because Disney's very specific and, you know, it has to be Disney. It can't be not Disney. So I don't know. It's like you like to make a statement and maybe you feel like you can make a statement with this movie. You don't need to add anything.
I feel like I am making a statement with this film. I just watched about 40 minutes of the film over the past weekend and I thought, okay, that looks like me. You know what I mean? I'm in there.
That's cool.
And that's pretty cool. And I also can say, look, this is a Disney film as well. And that's in there. And so, you know, it's been beautiful to be able to find that synthesis between what they do and what they're known for and the legacy of those films and what I'm trying to do. And that's what they said at the beginning that they wanted. So I'm just, I feel fortunate right now as we're shooting that they've followed through on that promise.
Yeah, I was curious when I heard that you were doing it.
Right, it sounds odd.
Is this going to work?
I love it, though. I think everyone's like, what? So I'm like, what is it? What is she doing? Fantastic. I like to be underestimated and over-deliver.
That's a good thing.
We'll see what happens.
So when you started 13th, then when did Queen Sugar and Wrinkle get added to the plate?
Yes. So 13th, we started talking about it right after Selma. So that was March of 2015. That summer, Oprah Winfrey offered me a series. So I started to write that while I was working on 13th. And then that fall of 2015, I got the call from Disney about thinking about Wrinkle. And so it really went into overdrive in January of 2016. I was juggling, but was going to have other people kind of work on Queen Sugar a little bit more and was going to maybe have some other people do interviews on 13th and was just not going to be as closely involved in those projects until my father passed away in March And then I drew them all close to me like my children, and I literally did not let them go. I mean, all I did all day was work on those three projects with, you know, crew members who are part of my family, like creative family. Many people worked across the three with me, the same editor across them all, you know, same music supervisors, composers across, you know, we just all hunkered down, and these were our three projects, and they were all ours. They were all a part of our day.
Long day.
Long day. Yeah, long day.
So now you're the first. You're the first African-American woman to be nominated for in the documentary category. Mm-hmm. You're the first or one of the first with a $100 million budget plus. First black woman. That's quite a thing. I mean, I don't want to ask you that tear-jerking question, but your father would be super proud.
It's it'd be too much. My father was from Lowndes County, Alabama, who lived in Montgomery, and literally every person he came around who crossed paths with him, even at the grocery store, before they would leave his presence, would know that his daughter directed Selma. I was like, Pop, how are you integrating this into conversations about produce? I felt like they wanted to know. It just came up. That's right.
So now we're in the run-up to Oscar, and you're nominated. Congratulations, of course. Some filmmakers can't come or won't come because of the ban. I don't know. It's
infuriating.
It's a shame that you have to have a moment in time that's not as pure as it could be, because that hangs over the whole thing, right?
Well, I'm excited. I think I'm going to have one of the best seats at I don't think I have the best seat in the place, but I'm like a seat inside of a ceremony that I hope, you know, shimmers with a real sense of, I don't know, justice and like-mindedness and what's fair and what's right and people speaking their minds. I think it's a night where you have 30 seconds to speak to the world. And, you know, you see what that can do. I mean, I loved Meryl's speech, and I love some of the things that I heard at SAG, you know, and I'd be interested in hearing what anyone has to say about where we are right now, whatever side they're on. I think it's a time for everybody to be talking more and speaking out more. That's why I wanted to sit down with Newt Gingrich and Grover Norquist. Like, we need to be talking to each other more directly without pretense, because this is a time that it becomes very dangerous if we don't.
I mean, bringing it back to 13th, it's like it was bad enough, and now it feels, I don't know, does it feel worse than you thought it was when you started making the film and you already thought it was bad?
I'd say yes. You know, I'd say yes. I mean, I think as a black person in this country, I'm really clear that there's a veil of politically correct rhetoric that is over really insidious systems and, you know, people who do not believe that, you know, people like me deserve the full fruits of democracy, if you will. But I can't say that I ever predicted that we'd be in a place where, you know, 2 weeks into a presidency, you'd have such sweeping, destructive, like openly hostile and very, very dangerous executive orders. I'm just going to sit at my desk and sign these off. We couldn't have predicted it. But you also couldn't have predicted spontaneous protests at airports around this country, and you couldn't have predicted those stunning numbers and pictures of women around the country out there protesting the way that we did the first 2 weeks. And so this country is changing, it's shifting, and it'll be up to forward-thinking people to be a part of what it gets crafted into. This is a time in history that will be long studied. And so the question is, what side did you stand on? What did you do? What did you say? And how did you act?
Ava DuVernay is the director of the Oscar-nominated documentary, 13th. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.